Dreamscape presents Husband Material by Alexis Hall, narrated by Joe Jameson. Part 1. Bridget Dawn Wells and Thomas Ballantyne, Chapel of St. Jude, Kentish Town, 22nd of May. Chapter 1. I've never seen the point of hen parties, though given my experiences of garden parties, dinner parties, and fancy dress parties, it might be that I just don't like parties in general, which, in retrospect, might explain why I spent so much of my party boy years being miserable and hating myself. Personal growth. I was nailing it. I was also nailing Bridges' hen-do, or rather her non-gender-specific bird do, because she was never going to want her big pre-wedding bash to exclude half her friends. Also, since she'd made me her maid of honour, it would have meant excluding myself, which would have been weird, even if, on some level, I might secretly have preferred an evening at home with my amazing barrister boyfriend. My amazing barrister boyfriend, who still felt like an amazing barrister boyfriend after 2 whole years. My amazing barrister boyfriend who, on account of the amazing barrister part rather than the boyfriend part, was currently running late. So there I was in the roped-off VIP area of an affordably swanky cocktail bar wearing a crocheted vulva hat. A bespoke crocheted vulva hat I'd commissioned from one of Bridges' friends when I realised that bachelorette party genital merch skewed strongly in the direction of all penis, all the time. And, obviously, I could have just not had genitalia-themed decor at all, but then it wouldn't have been a proper non-gender-specific bird do, and that would have made Bridge sad. And making Bridge sad was something I wanted to avoid, both in my capacity as maid of honour and in my capacity as her, you know, friend. James Royce plucked a dong-shaped lolly from the dong-shaped lolly jar. It was the first time I'd seen him, or his husband James Royce, without their newly adopted son, in months. Their newly adopted son, who they had, inevitably, named James. Although to avoid confusion, they just called him Baby J.
"I must say, Luke," he said, "I'm a little offended that you went with commercially produced phallic sweeties, rather than asking for my contribution."
Bernadette May, a relatively famous cookery book writer who Bridge had gone through so many work-related disasters with that they'd become friends out of sheer necessity, smouldered dismissively from across the table. She was one of those people who could smoulder at anything, and usually did.
"That's because your contribution would probably be a real horse's penis rolled in saffron and finished with gold leaf."
"Whereas yours," retorted James Royce, "would be a Victoria sponge topped with marzipan willies."
Which is why, I pulled my vulva more tightly over my head, I asked neither of you. This is our night to celebrate Bridget, not for you two to have a schlong-themed cook-off. Bridge was sitting beside me, wearing a penis hat and, like all of the guests, a T-shirt that, owing to a miscommunication on the phone with the printers, read, "Bridges, bitches, no, Oliver, I think it's fine, we're using it in the reclaimed sense, and anyway, it's too late to change."
"Actually," she said, "I think a schlong-themed cook-off would have been pretty cool."
"Non-gendered genitalia-themed cook-off," said Priya. "I'm not going home to my girlfriends and telling them that I went to a phallocentric baking event."
Girlfriends, plural, was a new enough development in Priya's life that it had messed up Bridge's seating plan. She and Teresa were still making it work, but an experimental threesome over Christmas had turned into a much less experimental set of regular hookups, which had turned into a solid official relationship, just as I was helping Bridge address the invitations. "You know," I told her, "Teresa and Andy would both have been super welcome. I made spare T-shirts for them and everything." Priya gave a dismissive shrug.
"Yeah, but the truly great thing about being in a throuple is that your partners can keep each other company, instead of having to come to shit like this where they have to pretend to like your asshole friends.
I winced. Can we remember that not everybody here knows everybody else, so calling people assholes might come across the wrong way?
It's fine.
That was Jennifer, who was sitting in her husband's lap sipping a cocktail through a perfectly ordinary straw, thank you very much.
Brian talks like that all the time.
Then again, said Peter from underneath her, Brian is kind of an arsehole himself. Bridget spread her arms wide in an effort to encompass the entire group.
How about we accept that I love you arseholes and leave it at that?
Thinking about it, James Royce-Royce was still inspecting his untouched phallic lolly.
We should probably have had arsehole-themed decorations as well.
I glowered at him. How about we definitely shouldn't? My search history is incriminating enough as it is.
Is it, though?
Priya was giving me an I-think-not look.
You and Oliver practically live together. I bet your search history is nothing but how to make vegan jam and scenic walks near Clerkenwell.
Scarily, non-gender-specific bird do aside, that was pretty accurate. You can't possibly know that.
Last week, said Priya in a devastating monotone, you emailed me to ask my opinion on a table lamp.
As one, the guests gasped.
Luke, cried James Royce-Royce. No, not a table lamp.
Shut up, I responded very maturely. Priya nodded gravely.
Yeah, he and Oliver are getting into raw, hardcore table lamping.
Shut up, I responded very maturely.
They're at it, she went on, nearly every weekend, in every room, on every table.
It was one table. I waved my hands despairingly. One time. Peering archly over his martini glass, James Royce-Royce raised an eyebrow.
That's how it starts. But before you know it, you'll be getting into the really kinky stuff like uplighters.
No uplighters, I yelled. Though Oliver had suggested that one would do wonders for the living area in my flat. I do hope, said Peter, that you're at least using surge protection. I stood in a way that I hoped was decisive, not huffy. I hate you all. Does anyone want another drink? Thankfully, most tails were already cocked, but a couple of Bridges' work friends called for a round of Cosmos. Cosmoi? On the way to the bar, I checked my phone to see if my amazing barrister boyfriend was actually going to show up. I'm so sorry, he'd texted, snowed under at work. I'll be with you as soon as possible. I'm so sorry, he'd texted again. I can't get away quite yet. I'm so sorry, he'd texted again. I'll be leaving in 10 minutes. And then, please don't worry. Everything is fine, and I'm definitely going to be on my way soon. Then, I'm sure you've thrown a wonderful party. Then, I realise this is substandard boyfriending. I'll make it up to you and to Bridget somehow. Then, leaving now, with you in 20 minutes. Then, traffic worse than expected. Sorry. This was so typically Oliver. I was mildly annoyed that he wasn't here, but his panicked texting was also weirdly endearing, and I was in love with him. So fuck. I was just in the middle of composing a playfully frustrated yet reassuring reply when I walked straight into the back of a solid wall of couple. Shit. My thumb slipped, and I accidentally sent Oliver a string of nonsense. Sorry, I wasn't... And then, my fucking ex turned round. The worst part about it was that for a tiny fraction of a second, before my head started to spin and my throat started to fill with imaginary frogs, I was almost pleased to see him. because we'd been together for 5 years, and the bit of my brain that had got used to being in love with him hadn't quite caught up with the whole he's a traitorous fuckface angle. "Oh my God," said the man who I'd once thought ruined my life. "Luke." "Miles," I yelped. "It's been ages." "Ages since you sold the intimate details of our relationship to a tabloid for 50 grand. But I smiled anyway, because he didn't deserve my emotional authenticity. He, on the other hand, smiled like he was genuinely happy we'd run into each other. He'd always had a knockout smile, and his new immaculately groomed beard only made it knockoutier. Prick, prick, total prick. "Hasn't it?" He turned to the implausibly perfect-looking young man by his side, a vision in glitter and rainbows. "Jojo, this is Luke. Luke, this is Jojo."
"Hi."
Jojo stood on tiptoes to kiss me on both cheeks.
"So, how do you know Miles?"
Had he not even mentioned me? Then again, how would he? "By the way, darling, you should know that my last relationship ended because I totally fucked the guy over." "Oh, we used to date." Miles had circled around and was standing very close to me now, and he'd put a hand on the small of my back in a way that was one part friendly, one part possessive. "Crazy times, right, Luke? And we've got so much catching up to do. Do you want to join us for a drink?" Even if I hadn't needed to get back to Bridges' party, that would have ranked pretty low on my things I want to do list, somewhere between getting my eyebrows burned off with a chef's blowtorch and spending a weekend in a bath full of dead squid. "I'd love to," I said, "but I'm actually really busy right now. Bridge is getting married, and she's made me her maid of honour, and my boyfriend is going to show up any minute." The moment I mentioned Oliver, I realised how pathetic I sounded. I might as well have come straight out and added, "But you wouldn't know him because he goes to a different school." "Oh, you're still friends with Bridge," said Miles. "Cool. I know you two always had that, you know, that 90s gay best friend thing going on." Was he serious? Was he fucking serious? I'm not sure I'd put it quite.
"And on the subject of weddings..."
Jojo was beaming like a cartoon sun.
"Can I tell him?"
Miles kissed his boyfriend on the top of his tiny head. "I think you're going to have to now."
"We're getting married."
I looked down at Jojo's outstretched hand, and sure enough, there was a sparkling band of diamonds, chosen with way more taste than I would ever have had, and honestly, way more taste than I would have expected Miles to have. Maybe he'd bought it with the money he got for selling me out. "Oh," I said, and then, realising that he was probably expecting a slightly bigger reaction, I added, "Congratulations." For a second, nobody said anything, but the awkwardness of the moment very much spoke for itself. Because how was I supposed to react to this? Here was Miles, smiling that shoe salesman smile at me, flaunting his adorable fiancée like he was one of those puppies you keep in a designer handbag, and acting like he hadn't completely fucking betrayed me. "Anyway," I continued, "I should... I might... yeah." I was just disentangling myself when the music changed and Tartarus came on. Tartarus, the breakout single from John Fleming's multi-platinum album Pendulum of the World. As part of the hype for the second season of the whole package, my dad had given this series of powerful, heartfelt interviews about how his struggle with cancer had made him confront his own mortality and realise what really mattered in life. Somehow the fact that he'd never had cancer in the first place, that nobody had even told him he had cancer or given him any reason to suspect he might have cancer, had got lost in the noise, and he'd become this poster child for survivors everywhere. He was even doing a public awareness campaign for the NHS. Anyway, Pendulum of the World was his album about how fucking wise and brilliant he was. Now he was a selfish old prick instead of a selfish young prick. And Tartarus was this navel-gazing dirge about staring into the abyss and coming back stronger that had won the bastard a Grammy and could entirely fuck off. Especially because the last thing I needed just when I'd had an unexpected run-in with the narcissistic ex who'd sold me out for short-term gain was to be reminded of my narcissistic dad, who'd sold me out for short-term gain. In an effort to distract myself, I looked down at my phone. My text to Oliver had somehow auto-corrected from "It's okay, see you soon," to "It's okay, see your document," which had prompted a series of replies reading, "What document? Was that text meant for me or somebody else? Lucian, is something wrong? I'll be there as soon as I can. If something is wrong, tell me. I'm sorry I took so long." And I should probably have replied, but I couldn't quite face it. Fate, or the universe, or whatever, had decided to rub my clearly happy and successful piece of shit ex and my clearly happy and successful piece of shit dad in my face within 30 seconds of each other. And while I was also technically clearly happy and successful, it felt a whole lot less clear with my amazing barrister boyfriend sitting in traffic while I was being introduced to fabulous, perfect, look how engaged and beautiful I am Jojo and his technicolour waistcoats and his sparkly ring. Especially since, as I suddenly remembered, I was still wearing a crocheted vulva on my head. Bridget's friends were relying on me for a Cosmo top-up, but right then, my maid of honour duties seemed less important than my get-the-hell-out-of-there duties. The bar was too loud and too hot, and I needed some air. So I tucked my phone into my jeans and slunk off to sit outside and do some good old-fashioned feeling sorry for myself. Except, as it turned out, even that was easier said than done, because we were in fucking London. So sitting outside would have meant plonking my arse down on a pavement that approximately 27 million people were trying to walk along at the same time, all desperately hurrying from wherever they had been to wherever they were going, and not inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to someone getting in their way. Not being quite self-loathing enough to let a whole city trample over me, I went to look for somewhere I could sit down, and, because of the previously mentioned London issue, failed to find anywhere that wasn't already occupied, and wound up wandering into a badly lit park that, in a better state of mind, I'd have avoided for fear of being murdered and/or arrested. And that was the point when I realised that my best friend had made me maid of honour for the wedding she'd been dreaming about since she was five, and I'd just bailed on her non-gender-specific bird do. Fuck. Fuckety, fuckety, fuck. In a way, it was comforting. People always worry that being in a relationship will change them, so it was good to know that being with Oliver hadn't completely destroyed my ability to be a shitty friend, and a shitty boyfriend, and an all-around shitty person. Fuck. At last I found an empty bench and collapsed onto it like a sack of deeply shitty potatoes, the kind that have been left in the kitchen too long and are getting weird knobbly things growing out of them. Because that was me, wasn't it? I was a knobbly, sprouting potato of a person. I'd been given the perfectly simple job of getting a bunch of people who liked each other to have a nice time in a bar full of fruity drinks and penis nibbles, and I'd managed to fuck even that up. I checked my phone again. Where are you? Fuck. I'd fucked that up too.
Where are you? Are you okay?
That wasn't Oliver. That was Bridge. Which meant she'd noticed I was gone. Which meant I was making her special night. Well, I suppose her actual special night was the wedding night, but her slightly less special night, all about me. I pulled off my crocheted vulva hat and stared at it, and it stared back accusingly, like a sexual eye of Sauron. Fuck. I was the worst maid of honour ever. Fuck. I was a bad friend and a bad boyfriend, and the reason people kept screwing me over and abandoning me was because I sucked and deserved it. Fuck.
Is this seat taken?
Turning around, I saw Oliver standing behind me. He looked a funny mix of composed and dishevelled, his tie loose around his neck, and his formal shirt unbuttoned to reveal his "Bridges, bitches, no Oliver, I think it's fine, we're using it in the reclaimed sense, and anyway it's too late to change" t-shirt beneath. He looked more worried than angry. "How did you find me?" I asked.
"Bridget said that you disappeared, so I asked around to see if anybody had seen a tall man with a vagina on his head running away from a cocktail bar."
"Vulva," I said.
"Pardon?"
"The vagina is internal. The external part is the vulva." Oliver gave me his warmest, reassuringest smile.
"Either way, it was a distinctive enough look that you weren't hard to find."
He came around the bench, sat down next to me, and put his arm around my shoulders. I leaned into him without even thinking about it.
"Bridget told me she saw Miles. She thought that might have been why you left."
I nodded. "They were playing my dad's song too." Oliver gave me a little squeeze.
"That sounds like quite the perfect storm. I'm sorry I wasn't there."
"So was I. Fuck, sorry, I mean it would have been great if you were there. I don't mean... I know you had to work."
"I know what you mean."
"It just would have been great to be able to say, 'Hi, Miles, fuck you, my life is great.'" Oliver gave a sort of half laugh.
"You could still have said it."
"Yeah, but I'd have had no proof."
"Your proof?"
One of these days I was going to stop being surprised when Oliver said exactly the right thing. But this wasn't the day. "For fuck's sake, Oliver, stop being so completely great." And for a while we just sat there, and I let myself feel safe and held and loved. And he took my hand and didn't say anything, because he didn't need to. "Also," I said, because I'd decided that feeling nice was overrated and I wanted to ruin the moment, "his fiancée is like 12.
"I assume not literally."
"No, but he's like this tiny little pretty boy called Jojo. I mean, who the hell is called Jojo?"
"I assume that's rhetorical."
"I'll tell you who's called Jojo," I went on. "A prick, that's who." Oliver was still there, and still, despite my decision to insult an innocent stranger, not judging me.
"Perhaps. Although, personally, I think the man who sold you out and made you afraid to ever trust anybody again is a bigger prick."
"Oh, yeah. He's a huge prick. Which is ironic, because his actual prick is quite tiny."
"Is that true?"
Oliver gave me another smile.
"Or are you just trying to make me feel special?"
"You know, I can't remember. But he deserves to have a tiny prick. And if you could tell all your friends he has a tiny prick, that would be fantastic, thanks." That made Oliver laugh.
"For you, Lucien, anything."
So I kind of had to kiss him. And then I kind of had to kiss him again, you know, just in case. And then it felt okay. Because the rest of the world didn't matter. I mean, it did, because I had, like, friends and a job and things I actually cared about. But Miles didn't matter. And Jojo certainly didn't matter. "I think," I said, "I think I can go back now." So we got up, I put my Volva hat back on my head, and I let Oliver Blackwood, my amazing barrister boyfriend, escort me back to my best friend's non-gender-specific bird party. And I knew, deep in my heart, that everything was going to be fine. After all, it wasn't like I was ever going to see Miles again. Chapter 2. Okay, I told Alex Twaddle. I was seriously running low on jokes, but the ritual was so much part of my life now that I wasn't about to give up on it. Let's try this one. There's a man who works on a bus selling tickets, and he loves his job, but one day he loses his temper with a passenger and throws them off the bus, and they fall under a car and die.
I say!
Alex looked outraged.
That's not on at all, especially not for a bus conductor.
No, I agreed. It's very poor behaviour, and, spoiler, you should remember that, because it might be relevant later.
Good to know.
For a moment, Alex looked contemplative.
I say, that might help with your jokes in general. Give a chap a bit of a pointer on what a chap's supposed to be paying attention to.
Duly noted. Anyway, he gets sent to court for throwing this passenger under a car. Alex nodded.
For being a bad conductor, you mean?
The Alex joke foreboding was beginning to rise up. Yes, I suppose so. Although I think they'd probably just have called it murder. Anyway, the judge sentences him to the electric chair.
I say, how ironic.
Abandon joke. Abandon joke now. Ironic in what way?
Well, you know, chap's a bad conductor, gets sentenced to the electric chair. I say, it'd be rather droll if he was such a bad conductor that the chair didn't work, wouldn't it? Be sort of like a play on words.
Yes. I was trapped. Trapped in an absurdist prison of meta-humour, with a posh nitwit who was secretly a genius that delighted in tormenting me. Yes, that would be droll. Anyway, they send him to the electric chair, and it doesn't work. Alex grinned.
Ah, because he's a bad conductor, you mean?
Yes.
No. Actually, old boy, it wasn't quite as droll as I'd anticipated. Not in practice.
There should have been some kind of joke-related emergency service you could call to rescue you in situations like this. Sorry.
Not your fault. Although, in retrospect, I think knowing the twist in advance made it less comical.
You don't say. Alex nodded.
Yes. You see, the essence of humour is surprise. So, if you want to get better at this joke-telling lark, you might want to keep your cards a little closer to your chest.
Thanks. I'll bear that in mind. Okay, this was it. I was nearly...
Tell you what, I'll show you how it's done.
There was no possible way this could end well.
I say, Rhys.
Alex stuck his head into the social media office.
Do you have a second?
Rhys Jones-Bowen emerged, walking backwards, and talking into his phone, which he was holding at a high selfie angle.
Hello, Internet, he was saying. This is Rhys Jones-Bowen from CRAPP, the Dung Beetle Charity. I've just finished up my morning coffee, and now Alex from the front office has called me through because he wants something, so I'm just going to see what that is and...
Rhys, I asked, what are you doing? He gave me a look like I'd asked a very silly question, which, to be fair, I had.
What does it look like I'm doing? I'm live streaming.
Is that a thing that's happening now?
Got to move with the times, Luke.
I treated him to my most sceptical expression. We really don't. Half our computers are still running Windows 7, and there's a map in the hall that shows two Germanys. Sadly, Rhys ignored my entreaty to keep the 21st century out of our office.
Why don't you say hello to the internet, Luke?
I refuse to believe that anybody is watching this.
Excuse me? I'll have you know I've got 573 viewers.
That seemed at once like not very many, and far more than I expected. Are you sure? He showed me his phone, and I watched as the 573 popped up to a 574, while beneath his video a stream of chat messages spammed variations on "Who's this prick?" and "Where's Rhys?"
"Can I tell you my joke now?" asked Alex. "Although, in the spirit of full disclosure, it's really more Luke's joke."
Rotating to bring Alex into frame, Rhys gave a nod.
"Go on then, this'll be great."
He made air quotes with his one free hand.
"Content, as we influencers call it."
Alex smoothed out his hair and did his best to look streamable.
"Right, so there's this bus conductor who's rather bad at his job, and a judge sentences him to be executed." "That seems a bit of an overreaction."
Rhys turned his attention back to his phone.
"You see, folks, that's the problem with the criminal justice system. The rich and the powerful, well, they can get away with anything. But ordinary people like you and me and this bus conductor, it's different rules for us, isn't it?"
If I'd been smart about it, I could have ducked out while they were distracting each other. I wasn't smart about it.
"It's just a joke, Rhys."
"It may be a joke, but it highlights a very real socio-political inequality."
He had a point. In the original version of the joke, he has legitimately killed somebody.
"But has he, though?"
asked Rhys Jones-Bowen, looking grave.
"Or was he just in the wrong place at the wrong time? You see, it's very easy, Luke, for you to sit there in your comfortable office and judge a man, but stories like this happen every day. An ordinary bus conductor is going about his business, and the years of abuse from an unfeeling public and the exploitative conditions he's been forced into by a privatised system of public transport..."
"Steady on." Alex had suddenly taken an interest. "I know a lot of chaps who did terribly well out of privatisation, picked up some absolute bargains, making themselves simply pots of money now, and they're all jolly nice fellows." Oh, God, what had I done? A simple pun about a slightly obsolete public sector job had turned into a debate about the long-term impacts of Thatcherism.
"You see, it's all right for them," Rhys was saying, "but you can't have one without the other, can you? For every one of your friends getting rich off the proceeds of crony capitalism, there's a poor bus conductor out there just trying to get by, accidentally killing a passenger because he's had to work a triple shift, because his daughter needs heart surgery, and the NHS doesn't have any free beds, and..."
"Should I..." I asked helplessly. "Should I have told the one that goes, 'What's brown and sticky?'"
"What is brown and sticky?"
asked Alex. I gave him an apologetic smile. "A stick."
"True."
Alex gave an approving nod.
"Yes, you should have told that one. It would have been less likely to get political."
Rhys was giving a no-harm, no-foul grin.
"Still, nice to have a good debate now and then, though, isn't it? Next week we'll do religion."
He turned his attention back to his phone.
"Anyway, folks, that's all from me now. I've got work to be getting on with. Remember to look up the CRAPP website and to follow us on the Twitter, the YouTubes, the Instagram, TikToks and OnlyFans. Be seeing you."
He closed the stream and slipped his phone back into his pocket. Rhys, I began tentatively, "what was that last platform you mentioned?"
"The TikToks. You've got to be on the TikToks these days, Luke. It's all about video content."
"Got to get with the 20th century," agreed Alex. No, not TikTok, I said. "The one after?" Rhys beamed.
"Oh, OnlyFans. Yes, I was reading this article and people were saying that it was getting very popular. And so I thought, as head of social media, I should probably be on that too. It's been doing rather well."
"Has it?"
"Oh, yes. People do keep asking me to take my shirt off, though.
I wasn't sure how far down this road I wanted to go. And do you?
Well, not in the last couple of weeks, because it's been quite nippy out.
Okay, so I wanted to go exactly this distance and no further.
Great, good on you. Nice to see that you're taking initiative. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got some very important fundraising to do.
I didn't exactly bolt, but I didn't exactly not bolt either. The advantage of having your own office was that it always gave you somewhere to hide when you suddenly discovered that one of your co-workers had unwittingly stumbled into the world of softcore pornography, which admittedly wasn't a thing that happened often, but was within the spectrum of things that happened often enough at crap that having a sanctuary was really, really nice. My ancient computer had barely finished booting up when my phone buzzed. The text preview read, "Just for your information," which told me it was Oliver before I even saw his name.
"Just for your information, I think we were photographed walking back to the party. I can send you the article if you'd like, but it's nothing to worry about." 2 years ago, I'd have seen it already, because my Google alerts would have told me about it. But the new, sensible, shit-together-having me didn't need to stare obsessively at every mention of my name in every scandal sheet. "It's cool," I texted back. "I trust you." The door swung open, and Alex Twaddle poked his head inside.
"Luke, old man, Dr. Fairclough wants to see you about something mediary."
Fuck, not again. "Actually, do send it to me. I might need it for self-defense." A couple of seconds later, a link to the offending piece popped up. The headline was, "We always knew he was a TW*T, which I thought was unfair for two reasons. Firstly, because they blatantly hadn't always known that. They'd just said it because of the hat. And secondly, because it wasn't like I was even doing anything. I was walking across a park with my boyfriend. If I hadn't been wearing a vulva on my head, it would have been quite a sweet picture. Hell, even with the vulva. But Dr. Fairclough wanted to see me anyway. Which was... it was not okay. Things had been going well for nearly 2 whole years. The most recent Beetle drive had been a huge success. We had more donors than ever. What more could I do here? Get a second, even more respectable boyfriend? Deciding that indignation felt better than dread, I marched up to Dr. Fairclough's office and showed myself in.
"Ah, O'Donnell," she said. "I've just seen this picture."
She rotated her screen towards me, and there we were. Me, Oliver, and the vulva hat. And this time, I wasn't backing down. "Yep, that's me. And that's my boyfriend, who I love. And that's a hat shaped like a vulva, because I was celebrating a friend's hen night and I thought having only penis hats would be heteronormative and or transphobic. So, yes, I was walking through the park with a set of labia crocheted to my face and I am not ashamed. And if CRAPP has a problem with that, then they should remember that this time I'm dating a lawyer and I'll take them to fucking court." Dr. Fairclough blinked exactly once.
"I wanted to make sure you were okay."
"Oh." It's not that I'd been looking for a fight, but I did feel a bit like a matador who'd shown up at the arena only to have the bull politely ask if I needed it to hold my cape.
"After all," she went on, "it's a very mean headline. They call you a twit."
They hadn't, in fact, called me a twit. "I've had worse." Dr. Fairclough blinked exactly once more. Sometimes I thought she genuinely was part praying mantis.
"Well, thank you for this little talk. I hope you consider yourself to be emotionally supported."
In a funny way, I did. Yes, I was pretty sure that Dr. Fairclough believed that human feelings were an evolutionary dead end caused by a misguided lack of exoskeleton. But she was trying, and I could give her points for that. Thanks, Dr. F.
Don't call me Dr. F.
Sorry. Thank you, Dr. Fairclough. My life was in a good enough place that not getting told I had to change my entire personality or lose my job felt like relief rather than elation. But I was still relatively upbeat when I got back to my office and started pinging emails to people who had promised us money at the Beetle Drive. An hour or so later, there was a knock at my door. This was unusual in itself, because crap wasn't a knocking kind of office. It was a poking your head in, wandering through without being asked, spilling hot coffee on you kind of office. "Come in," I said, without really thinking about it. And there was Miles. Without his fiancée, but still looking like a man who knew full well he was engaged to a tiny ball of sparkling wonder and was borderline smug about it. "Hi." I was too shocked to be angry, too angry to be depressed, and too depressed to be shocked. "Hello?" I tried to make it half greeting, half interrogation. After we met the other night, I got talking to Jojo and I explained who you were and why things had been awkward. Were things awkward?" I asked, in my most casual, I definitely didn't have to run away and hide voice. "You know they were. And I know things between us ended badly." I almost couldn't bring myself to call him out on that. But only almost. Ended badly? You fucking sold me out to the fucking tabloids. That's not us ending badly. That's you completely shafting me. "I was young and stupid and reckless." "You were young and an asshole." "Be fair, Luke." He gave me that knockout smile of his. "You were kind of an asshole yourself." "Okay, so we were both assholes. But only one of our assholes walked away 50 grand richer." Somehow he had the gall to act disappointed. "Don't make this about the money. It wasn't about the money." "Oh, good. So it was about deliberately hurting me, was it? That makes it so much better." Without being asked, Miles sat down in my office's one free chair. "That's not what I meant. I guess I was feeling trapped and it seemed like a way out." "And the cash was just a bonus?" Finally, he had the common decency to look ashamed. "And so," I powered on, "you rock up here and tell me this after all these years, and what, that's supposed to make it okay?" He hung his head. "Not okay, no. I wanted... Jojo want... We wanted to invite you to the wedding." "I'm sorry." I glared at him. For one completely absurd and obviously incorrect minute, I thought you said you wanted to invite me to your wedding. "Yes." There was no way I was having this. "Let me think. How about no? How about no way in fucking hell? What are you even talking about, you piece of absolute shit? You've got to..." Fuck. It was happening again. I was Bruce Willis in Die Hard 2 with the same shit happening to me twice. "And don't say I've got a right to be angry. I know I've got a right to be angry. The thing is, until you barged into my office like Bargy McBargeface, I didn't have to be angry because I didn't have to think about you at all. I could think about ordinary things like my job and my boyfriend and the fact that one of my co-workers doesn't realise he's an amateur porn star." "An amateur? Don't ask." Miles stood up, straightening his jacket in a way that said, "I am being the only reasonable person in an unreasonable situation." "Look," he said, "I knew it was a risk coming here." "What did you think you were risking exactly? Because it seems to me like you had nothing to lose from this little visit whatsoever." Apparently he was going to blank that. "It'd mean a lot to Jojo if you came." "I don't even know Jojo. Why does he give a shit? Why should I give a shit?" You were a big part of my life, so it seems right that you should... This was making sense. Bullshit sense. Selfish sense. Very, very Miles sense. Oh, right. So it's an absolution thing. You want me to be there so that you can put the shitty thing you did to me behind you and start a new shiny life with your new shiny husband and say to yourself, it's okay, no need to feel bad, Luke's fine with it, he came to my wedding and everything. Think about it. From inside his jacket, Miles retrieved a delicately printed piece of cream-coloured card and laid it on the desk beside me. Moving on will be best for both of us. And that was the problem. I had moved on. I'd moved on really fucking well. Just go. He just went, stopping in the door on the way out to give me an enigmatic, see you around. Then I was left sitting at my desk, staring at a wedding invitation with swirly silver writing saying, Mr. Miles Edward Green and Mr. John Joseph Ryan request the pleasure of your company as they celebrate their union. RSVP. Chapter 3. It was my turn to cook, by which I mean it was the one night a month when my overwhelming sense of guilt at never cooking overrode both my and Oliver's awareness that I was horrendously bad at it. Since Oliver had, after a long email exchange with Bronwyn, come to the conclusion that it was ethically unsupportable to be vegetarian but not vegan, if you claim to care about animal welfare, and had therefore cut out animal products entirely, I'd decided to make a sweet potato, chard and celeriac rainbow-layered pie, which had seemed like a great idea when I'd googled good vegan recipes a couple of days ago, then seemed like quite a poor idea when I'd been wandering around Tesco's, wondering where the fuck they kept their celeriac, then turned out to be an unbelievably poor idea once I'd started trying to make it. For a start, store-bought pastry wasn't vegan, so I'd had to make it from scratch, and I quickly learned that whipping up your own pastry from coconut milk, flour and almond oil was really, really hard. Especially when, according to the recipe, you were supposed to do it in the 20 minutes your beetroot was roasting in the oven, so everything would be nice and ready when the time came to combine it all. 1 hour and 10 minutes into the 1 hour prep time that the recipe had promised, I was covered in flour to my elbows, juggling 3 different roasting tins that had to go into the oven at different times, trying to work out whether my pastry needed more coconut milk, I'd bought extra in case, or more flour, I'd bought extra in case, or less of one or the other, in which case, how was I meant to take it out, and fast returning to my monthly realisation that I should never, ever be allowed in a kitchen. Eventually I got the pastry to a sort of Play-Doh consistency, where I could just about squidge it into a cake tin and start filling it with layers of charred leaves and semolina, which would apparently absorb the juices, but which I was beginning to strongly suspect would not, in fact, absorb anything. I wrestled the whole mess into the oven, set the timer, and made a brief despairing effort to clean up, before realising that I had no idea where to start. Oliver arrived home, just as the smoke alarm went off. "Smells delicious," he yelled from the hall, before heading into the front room, grabbing a sheaf of documents he'd been working on and waving them frantically under the smoke alarm. "Thanks. It's supposed to be a pie."
"And what's it actually going to be?"
"Honestly?" I came through from the kitchen, yoinked the papers gently out of his hand, and took over waving duty. "Probably a takeaway?" The beeping stopped, and Oliver recovered his documents before giving me a belated honey I'm home kiss on the cheek.
"I'm sure it'll be fine."
It was never fine, but over the course of our relationship, I'd watched Oliver gamely chomp his way through roasted squash that was practically mulch, spinach soup that was practically jam, and more watery stews than I could keep track of.
In the end, I served up a kind of vegetable gruel with bits of either burned or raw crust floating in it, like incredibly shit dumplings. Oliver seasoned his liberally and tucked in. "Are you okay?" he asked, once he'd managed to swallow a particularly tricky lump of chard. "This is fine, but from the mess..." He indicated the carnage that still filled the kitchen. "It seems like you were more than normally distracted." I took a deep breath. This wasn't going to be a big deal. I wasn't going to let this be a big deal. "It's Miles." "I'm sorry. I didn't realise seeing him shook you up that much." "No, I mean, it's Miles again. Like, he came to see me." Between his training as a professional barrister, a lifetime of nodding and smiling for his judgmental parents, and 2 years of pretending to like my cooking, Oliver had one hell of a poker face. But I thought I saw a flattering hint of jealousy creep into his eyes. "When?" "Today, at work." Oliver frowned. "That seems inappropriate." "Yeah, Miles has never been big on appropriate." To be fair, neither had I. "What did he want?" "He wanted to say, 'I made a terrible mistake. Run away with me.' And I said, 'Of course I will, big boy. I'm packing my bags this evening.'" Oliver put down his fork and gave me a stern look. "Lucien." "He wanted to invite me to his wedding."
"Ah."
For a moment, he was quiet.
"Do you want to go?"
I was a bit surprised he'd even asked. "Of course not. It would be fucking weird."
"Well then."
He reached across the table and took my hand. I thought it was meant to be affectionate, but he probably also wanted an excuse to stop eating the pie.
"That seems to be a problem with a very simple solution."
"It's just... fuck." He'd done that thing where he was all supportive of my choices to make me confront the fact that I wasn't actually sure about them. "I keep wondering if it might be good for me, maybe." His thumb traced gently across my knuckles, like we had all the time in the world, and nothing mattered more than this conversation right now.
"Good in what way?"
"I don't know, sort of closure-y. Like it might help to be able to stand up and say, 'Hey, you totally destroyed me that one time, but I'm fine now, so I wish you well.' Also, I'd really like to show up at his wedding with my gorgeous, successful boyfriend and rub it in his stupid, smug, beardy face." Oliver laughed.
"Should I feel flattered by that, or exploited?"
"Oh, we're too special for a bit of exploitation now, are we?"
"Depends on the situation."
It was nice to be able to have this, just sitting with Oliver being very slightly flirty, even while I was having a mini-crisis. But that didn't make the mini-crisis less crisis-y. "I keep going in circles," I told him. "One moment I'll be all, 'Why are you even considering this? Fuck him.' And then I'll be like, 'But isn't that giving him more power over you?' Then I'll be back to, 'Or maybe that's what he wants you to think,' and... ugh, gah!"
"You're a complicated man, Lucien O'Donnell."
"Thanks, I try," I sighed. "I guess the whole 'let us reconcile even though I shafted you' thing is bringing up a lot of stuff. And I'm not sure where I want to, well, put the stuff it brings up." Oliver gave me a reassuring nod.
"That makes sense. But for what it's worth, I don't believe this is as much like your dad as you might be thinking."
That's exactly what I was thinking, even if I hadn't put it into quite those words. "Isn't it, though? Aren't I just setting myself up to go through life with people shitting on me and then saying, 'Hey, remember that time I shat on you? It'd be great for me if you could put it all behind you and say we're cool now.'"
"I think, or rather I hope..."
He gave me earnest eyes over the remains of his bowl of non-pie.
"That the difference is, you're not invested in Miles. He's not trying to be a part of your life.
He's only asking you to come to his wedding. And he's probably asking for selfish reasons. I don't doubt that it's about making him and his new husband feel better rather than making you feel better. But he's not asking you to commit to anything.
They'll expect a gift.
Oliver smiled.
Then get them a toast rack and put a note in it asking when he's going to pay back the £50,000 he owes you.
I enjoyed seeing Oliver's mean side. It didn't come out very often, but when it did, it was usually on point. I might do that. If I go. Should I go?
You know I can't make that decision for you.
Why not? It would be super convenient. You could just say, "Sorry, Lucien, I'm wildly jealous and I refuse to let you go to Miles's wedding."
"Sorry, Lucien," repeated Oliver obligingly. "I'm wildly jealous and I refuse to let you go to Miles's wedding."
"Oh, that's rubbish." I gave him my best sulky face. "You clearly don't mean it." Oliver cast me a look of mock contrition.
"I know. I'm an inadequate boyfriend, and I don't know why you put up with me."
"You must have a preference, though," I wheedled. For a moment, Oliver thought about it. He was never a man to give a hasty answer to an important question.
"Well, I'd be lying if I said that attending the wedding of a total stranger was my idea of a fabulous night out. And you don't owe Miles anything, so neither he nor Jojo should be a factor here."
"I feel like you're about to drop a massive but on me."
"I was heading that way, but now I feel you've cut my butt off at the pass."
This was a very serious conversation about very serious things, and Oliver was taking time out of his evening to boyfriend at me. But there was no way I was letting that go without comment. "Oliver, I would never cut your butt off."
"Lucien."
His eyes had gone all soft, while his mouth was trying really hard to be severe.
"You're making it very hard for me to finish my sentence."
Sorry. I paused. "Butt me."
"But," said Oliver carefully, "just because Miles is behaving selfishly, that doesn't mean that going to his wedding wouldn't be good for you. If going along and drawing a line under the past would make you feel better, you shouldn't not do it just because it might make him feel better too. Does that make sense?"
It did. Kind of. "But what if knowing it'll make him feel better makes me feel worse?"
"Then maybe you need to revisit the 'does he have power over you' question."
"Oh, right." My shoulders drooped. I was supposed to be not like this anymore. "Why do people keep having power over me?"
"Well, one of them was your father, so power is rather a given. And the other is someone you were in love with who betrayed you."
"So I have to go to the wedding to prove..." I had no idea where I was going with that, but thankfully Oliver interrupted me.
"You don't have to do anything to prove anything. To anyone. Not Miles, not me, and not even yourself."
That's what he thought. He wasn't me.
"In any case," he went on, "you have time. You can think about it. And if you want to go, of course I'll be with you. And if you don't, I'll still be with you. And we'll do something much more interesting than watching your ex-boyfriend and somebody you've met once throw a massive expensive party in celebration of a relationship that doesn't mean anything to you."
I blinked. Wow, that's a cynical take on marriage even for me. And my dad was a junkie arsehole who walked out on my mum before I could talk.
"I'm not opposed to marriage in general."
Oliver gave a tight little smile.
"I'm just not the sort of person who can get invested in the trappings if I'm not invested in the couple."
I didn't think I was either, really. I'd only agreed to help organise Bridget's wedding because she was my best friend, and I was pretty sure she'd do all the important planning herself. Of course, Part of it was that for most of my life it hadn't looked like marriage was a thing I'd ever be able to do. And in some ways it was nice to think if I was growing up today, I'd be able to be one of those kids spending his days planning his fantasy wedding to the man of his dreams. But in other ways, it felt kind of like I'd missed out. I get it. And just to be clear, I'm not invested in Miles at all. Like, not at all. Not even a little tiny bit. Good. There was a firmness in that good that felt more definite than his I'll support you no matter what demeanour implied. Oliver, I said, because I wanted this on record, you are actually just a smidgen jealous, aren't you?
No.
The response was far too quick to be convincing. I grinned triumphantly. You are? Oh my God, you are! That's amazing, because it means you like me so much you don't want anyone else to have me. Or possibly super insulting, because it suggests I'm so damaged I'll go back to a guy who sold me out and is marrying someone else.
Well, obviously I like you, Lucien, muttered Oliver. In general. Not necessarily right now. And I know it's irrational. While I have a long history of people leaving me, it's always been for quite banal reasons. Not because they decided to run off with their ex at his own wedding.
Once upon a time, this would have been a teasing opportunity, and I'd have said something like, I promise when I leave you, it'll be over something trivial. But Oliver had been dumped a lot, and even though he'd know it was a joke, it would be a joke that hurt. I promise I'm not going to leave you. Not over Miles. Not over you going vegan. Not even over that time you got really upset at me for leaving my socks in the living room. That perked him right up. His eyes got a steely glint.
There is a place, he said, for socks.
And it probably said something weird about my brain, or our relationship, that Oliver chiding me about my socks was a little bit of a turn-on. I'm sorry. I made a futile attempt to sound contrite. I'm just a filthy sock harlot.
Lucien, are you attempting to turn my irritation at your failure to pick up after yourself into some kind of sex game?
I shot him a hopeful look. Is it working?
Well, you have made a terrible mess of the kitchen.
I know. I deserve to be punished.
You've already been punished, Oliver pointed out. You had to eat that dreadful pie.
That is very much not the type of punishment I had in mind. Standing, Oliver neatly cleared the bowls from the table.
I don't think framing sex with me as a punishment is quite the compliment you think it is.
Well, I don't think come and do me because you like me so much has quite the right flirtatious edge.
But Lucien...
Oliver's voice had gone very low and very soft.
I do like you. I like you very, very much.
Okay, maybe that was working. Except even after 2 years of relationshiping and self-care and emotional development, it still scared me how vulnerable sex could make me feel. Which meant it was way easier to say, "Spank me, Daddy," which we both knew I didn't mean, then hold me, I love you, which I definitely did. And I was just trying to find a way to articulate this, see above, re-emotional development, when Oliver came back, unbowled, and took me firmly by the wrist. What are you... I started, as I found myself manoeuvred onto the table.
I'm showing you how much I like you.
Ugh... Help. My feelings. I made a valiant attempt not to melt everywhere. I'll feel bad if we damage this table.
Really? He asked. I won't care in the slightest.
And then he kissed me, and I stopped caring too. Because whatever else was going on, in spite of Miles and Jojo Ryan and Bridget's wedding and the mess of my past... and the mess I was probably going to make of my future, Oliver was mine, and I was his. And I was kind of completely, embarrassingly, disgustingly in love with him. Especially when he knew exactly how to touch me, rough and tender and careful and endlessly Oliver. When he knew how to make me forget my uncertainties and my self-consciousness, so that I wasn't afraid to cling to him like I needed to cling, and let him cling to me the way he needed to cling back, and tell him how wonderful he was, how happy he made me. All the other things I was just beginning to find words for. And not even say, "I told you so," when we totally wrecked the table.